You're listening to a Day1.fm show.
Pick My Brain is the podcast where founders pitch me their startup and I try to give them some useful advice so they can connect better with potential co-founders, investors, media, and of course, customers. My name's Alan Jones and I was a founder myself for about 15 years, and after that an angel investor for another 15 years, so yeah, old. Some of my ventures have been successful and some failed disastrously, but I like to think I've learned a thing or two along the way, and maybe some of that can help you. So if you'd like to learn how to tweak your pitch, subscribe to the Pick My Brain show now, wherever you like to listen to podcasts.
We become effectively the issuer of the cards, and we recently signed, in the last 6 months, we signed a six-year exclusive arrangement with MasterCard for Australia and New Zealand.
Welcome to FinTech Fun. FinTech Fun is a podcast where Australian fintechs come to share their stories.
Hi, it's Chris Titley here. As part of the FinTech Fun podcast series, I'm joined by Alistair Wilkie, CEO and Managing Director of Change Financial, an ASX-listed company. Thanks for coming into the studio and having a chat.
Great, Chris. So very nice to see you again. It's been quite some time since we caught up last.
It's nice. A beautiful Brisbane day, by the way, here in late August at the moment. Al, let's talk about Change Financial, going back to the early days when the company was called, I think it was Chimp Change back in the day. You want to give a bit of a history of the business and how it all began?
Sure. Well, actually, the initiation of this business was really founded out of trying to address the underbanked in the United States, and a number of people got together and commenced a process of actually building a card platform that would actually serve as the underbanked in the United States. And that ran for a couple of years. And look, long story short, it was really about the guys taking on more responsibility, building a processor, looking to the US market for a lot of their business. And that changed probably around 2018, 19. And we started to really progress with building out capabilities and looking for a strategic plan to focus on a global market rather than restricted to the US. And I think one of the key inflection points in the business was really in 2020, when we actually made a strategic acquisition here in Australia, which was we bought the assets of a company called Wirecard, which gave us a global footprint. And we really commenced that journey in earnest in 2020, when we combined both what we did in the US in terms of all the technology, plus what we had acquired here in Australia. So we've spent the last 18 months to 2 years actually combining and integrating these technologies into the platforms that we have today.
And Al, the acquisition of Wirecard, do you want to talk about that process, how it happened, and then I suppose why it is such a bit of a game changer for your organization?
Yeah, really good question, Chris. Look, in
that was Wirecard Australia.
Yes, it was.
Company, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Look, Wirecard was a global business with a bigger market cap than Deutsche Bank at one point, and they really grew through acquisition. But they didn't do a lot with the business, in truth, particularly what they acquired down here in New Zealand and Australia. So the assets came up for sale in 2020. When we had a look at that, there was a number of bidders, about 8 bidders for this particular asset sale. And what we saw in there was an answer to perhaps a three-year strategic plan that we had. Because what they had here in Australia was aligned with our technology stack. They had an existing customer base in 30-odd countries, a recurring revenue stream, 65 staff that were skilled and trained in payments. And quite honestly, they were going to address a lot of the functional changes and developments we were going to do. So it was a very strategic asset that we bought there that's changed the whole game for us in the last 2 years.
And talking about the technology and how you make money, can you describe the business model? Is it B2C, is it B2B, or B2B2C, or a combination of both?
No, strictly a business to business. It's actually one thing that I believe confuses some of the market, because they see us in payments and they naturally think that we're a consumer provider, whereas actually the reality of it is that we're a B2B provider. So our main client bases are really mid-sized banks and fintechs, which are the core of our business. And also one of the things that we've done to change the way that we focus on the market is to simplify the business. You know, it's very complex and very regulated in what we do. And what we've said to the market in the last 2 years since we've combined these two businesses, we're here to simplify the payments experience. It's kind of the mantra that we hold true to ourselves. And we only have two key solutions that we take to market. One is a core platform, which is the combination, as I said earlier, of our two businesses, which is a core card management solution. It's got processing, and I'll talk a little later, I guess, about some of the key milestones we've achieved in this last year. So it provides payment cards for banks, fintechs throughout the globe. And the other is a payments testing solution, which is used in 130 clients in 30-odd countries. And it really tests a lot of what actually goes on between the payment transfers. So I'll use an example to illustrate the point. So FPOS is one of our major clients here in Australia, and anybody who wants to join in that domestic scheme to actually issue FPOS cards actually uses our technology to test and certify their transactions across the network.
And from someone that's not overly au fait with the whole scheme of payments, it sounds very technical and it sounds like there's a lot of regulation. Where does someone like a Visa and MasterCard sit in that compared to where you play?
Yeah, look, the Visa and MasterCard are actually core components of what we require in order to make our business successful. And again, perhaps better to illustrate this in that as a core platform and card provider on a global basis to banks, then we actually have integration with all of the major schemes. So Amex, JCB, Diners, China, UnionPay, Visa, MasterCard. So we can actually provide services to banks who actually have those relationships with those schemes. But in more recent times, what we've done is we've decided to take a step into what's called direct issuing, which means we can take the bank out of that whole integration and we become effectively the issuer of the cards. And we recently signed, in the last 6 months, we signed a 6-year exclusive arrangement with MasterCard for Australia and New Zealand to actually provide direct issuing into the Australia and New Zealand market.
So if I'm a fintech and I want to provide a payments facility, I can have a card that's issued in my particular company's name at the back end and all the processing's done by Change?
Not quite. What would happen in that instance with direct issuance is that we in Australia and New Zealand would be the issuer. So when you look at the back of your card and you see the name, it would be Change Financial as the issuer.
Okay.
Yep. Okay, so that's how it would work. As a fintech, to answer your question, what we would do is provide you with a platform, we would do the integration. Typically, we find the fintechs have an application, they have a front end and they want to monetize it, but they don't have the wherewithal from either a capital point of view or perhaps the technology skills necessary to integrate their app with the payments industry. So we provide a full one-stop shop for them. So we can provide the platform, we can provide all the regulatory approvals through our issuing, we can provide services to help them onboard clients. So we have a real wide range of services that we provide as a sort of one-stop shop so the fintech can plug into us and they can, within a reasonable amount of time, actually be up and running with a card in market.
And in terms of the geography, you started in the US and you said with that Wirecard acquisition, where are your customers based now from a geographic mix?
Right, so actually initially we were only US-centric and so that only allowed us because we, in the US, you must have actually an issuing bank. You must be part of that
network.
It
was a sort of a smaller regional bank, I seem to recall.
That's right, yeah. We actually did work with an organization in the Central America and they were our first issuing bank. We've subsequently enhanced that and we signed up a new issuing bank in Florida called Axiom as recent as 9 months ago, which is important for our steps for us to grow our business in the US, which we have actually done subsequent to integrating that bank in with our services. And but to answer your question around the scale and the reach of our business, so while initially it was just the US, having acquired this new business and integrated, we now actually have 156 clients in 41 countries.
Wow.
And some of those are the biggest banks in those countries. So in the Philippines, we have the largest bank as one of our clients there. But we're all over Southeast Asia, Latin America. We have small presence in Africa, but nothing to really mention. And a very strong presence down here in Australia and New Zealand, or as we call it, Oceania.
Mm. And talking about the current state of the business, can you give a bit of an update on where Change sits at the moment as we're sitting here in August 2022?
Sure. Well, look, this last year is about building blocks. We did a lot of the integration in 2020 in terms of spending a lot of time transitioning our customers, you know, getting them all comfortable, building up our plans. And through the 2021 period, in 2022, we part of our strategic 3-year strategic plan was actually to build blocks that we needed in order to be successful into the global market. And these included, as I mentioned, the MasterCard arrangement. That was a critical component of our building block. So we signed a 6-year exclusive deal that is great for us because it has large incentive payments when we secure new customers. We also signed up with a US issuing bank, which was another key building block. In order to do direct issuing, one of the other core components of our strategy was that we need to be regulated. So we have applied, subsequent to our agreement with MasterCard, for a financial services provider license in New Zealand, which we've secured now. And we are now in the final stages of securing an Australian financial services license for Australia. And that is imminent. We don't know exactly when because they're a bit slow at the moment.
That's right. They put a few things on hold. They've had a little hiccups, I suppose, or COVID certainly was one of them. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah, so look, we've put a lot of effort in the last sort of 12 months to putting the major building blocks in place, and we've communicated that with our...
that's all right. You can bang the table as well.
We've communicated that with our shareholders from the outset. We every year we put out here's our key plans and key milestones for the year, and we did that at the start of last year, and really happy to report that we've achieved almost all of those goals. And I suppose one of the biggest ones that we've achieved in putting together all those great building blocks is that we've now secured new clients in the United States. About 6 months ago, we signed up 3 new clients, fintechs, to operate out of the US on the back of our Axiom Bank relationship. And in more recent terms, just there in June, we finalized the contract for a number of building societies and credit unions in New Zealand. Which is a massive deal for us, worth about 15 million Aussie, 10 million US dollars, and forward revenues for us. So it was fantastic because the New Zealand part of this new contract we've just signed is actually utilizing every aspect of what we built in the last 12 months. Mm. And that really validated that investment. So again, I suppose that was part of the attraction with our cap raise, was that we've set the foundations, we've built the necessary components to be successful, and we've secured new clients on the back of that.
And just on that cap raise, do you want to give some of the details around the funds and use of funds and how you're pleased with the outcome?
Yeah, no, look, it was a really good result for us, Chris. There's two components to the cap raise, which we just launched recently. One was a placement offer for $750,000, which was oversubscribed and underwritten to, and we've now completed that. And we issued 15 million, or we will issue 15 million new shares on the back of that. So we did a one share for every 4 that you was on offer. So that's now done and dusted in part, and we've just recently gone to market with a non-renounceable entitlement offer. And that's gone out to all of our existing shareholders who, again, have largely underwritten it in the case that some of our existing shareholders don't want to take up the full offer. So it's for $5 million. And they're going to issue an extra 99.5 million shares on the back of that. And we expect that to conclude at the end of August, and perhaps it will all be finalized in early September. So really exciting. And we've had a great response to it with a good help from MST and Henslow, who helped us with putting the placement and the entitlement offer. And obviously want to thank our colleagues at Altar Capital, who really helped us drive that process.
Moving forward, 12 months' time, or even over the last couple of years, some commentary around the fintech sector as a whole, why you're excited, why you're playing in this space, and you're seeing any themes that you can share in regards to that kind of pricks your ears up in terms of interest?
Yeah, look, I don't know if I've got much of the prick the ears up, but it's been a challenging journey because we are a global fintech, and although we're a public company, we still have all the other aspects to take care of operationally as being a fintech that's on a growth journey. And I suppose growth is where I'd probably enter into the conversation because, you know, I'd say 6 months or more ago, everybody was fixated on growth. It was the major condition for anybody to invest
at all costs.
At all costs and almost at any cost. Yeah. And without naming names, obviously, some of the bigger buy now, pay later organizations had huge successes in raising capital but never turned a profit. Mm. And I think it was really a growth strategy that they followed. Well, it was very apparent to us in the last 3 months, I guess, 3 to 6 months, as we were considering what we would do on cap rates, is that we would have to sort of amend, let's say, massage our plans, not from a pure growth strategy to a growth strategy aligned with maximizing on our and optimizing on our business in terms of our costs, but also to focus on how we actually create a pathway to profitability, which we successfully concluded in terms of our the plans that we put together. So at this stage, you know, you asked me about the use of funds in terms of the cap raise. They'll be used to help us continue on the development roadmap that we have. We're going to pay off some debt that we took on board at the end of the year just to bridge the gap. We're also going to use that for working capital. And we also are just put some new people into Southeast Asia to enhance and grow our business there. So the real thing for us is this pathway to profitability. And we've declared publicly on the back of the cap raise that we are in, we will be in a position where we'll be EBITDA positive in the second half of this year.
And now when you're not running a public company, you're not raising $5 million, you're not massaging your strategy and you're talking about profitability. What do you get up to? What are you figuring in your downtime? This is the podcast is called FinTech Fun, so we might as well have a little bit of fun in learning about your life and your background and what you get up to.
Yeah, look, I'm quite a private person, Chris, but for the purposes of this, of course, I'm going to reveal all.
Exclusive here, by
exclusive.
The way.
You heard it here first.
Yeah.
Oh, look, I have, you know, I'm obviously not from these parts originally. I've spent the last 18 years of my life here in Australia and the first 22 years of my career in the United Kingdom, but working on a global basis. But coming back to what really gets me out of bed in the morning, what fun do I have? Well, actually, I've been a fitness guy all my life. You know, it's been part of my story. Is
what time?
Yeah, and for 45 years or more, maybe 50, because I do have a 6 in front of my number these days. And I've always maintained a high level of fitness, and I'm quite the outdoors person as well. So the sort of things that I've really enjoyed for the last 30 years has been cycling. You know, I'm one of those Lycra guys, you know, you see them on the weekend.
The middle-aged.
Middle-aged, yeah, you got it.
So at the coffee shop after a big bike ride.
But yeah, fitness, I've always been to high level our commitment to my fitness. Yep. And I think that really helps with the business. You know, it gives you clear air time. It gives you time to concentrate and focus on some challenges when you're out doing pedaling through the roads. But in more recent times, I've taken up things like walking. I got a dog 2-3 years ago, so I have a walk every morning with my dog.
It's
which
a
is
a nice place to walk sometimes here in Brisbane, isn't it? Beautiful.
Yeah. Four or five. Yeah, but so the fun, and also fun, it's funny you should mention the fun because I have this really, maybe it's part of my Scottish heritage, but I just love the Billy Connolly aspect of life, of making fun out of things that might seem a bit serious or perhaps you don't talk about. And I've made it my life's commitment and desire to make people laugh.
It's a good trait to have, I think, particularly as you're managing staff that, you know, someone told me that you're not on the operating table at some point in time, you know, like you think people are worried about various things, but you're not on the operating table. So let's, you know, you can take a step back and you know, sometimes you can't smile, but certainly try and smile. Yeah,
exactly. I always challenge myself to make people laugh within a very short time I meet them, whether I've met them before or not. Mm. And it's more subliminal now than it is in reality.
We've had a few guests that have that love cooking. We've had a few guests that love traveling, skiing, snowboarding. I'm going to go onto the food train here. For you know, being in Brisbane and you have some guests from out of town, where do you take them for a feed?
Oh, look, I've got a... Actually, food and fun and wine are actually part of my passion. Mm. You see, now I'm beginning to reveal stuff.
That's
so
right. I'm unpacking the layers. You it's are. My job, right? Yeah.
So fitness has really been an important part, but you see, the corollary of that is that actually I'm a bit of a wine buff. So I built myself a really nice wine cellar at home. I have, for the last 35, 40 years, been interested in wine and food. I like to cook, but my wife is an exceptional cook, so I don't try and compete on that front. But the wine has been part of my passion, and I've had the good fortune as part of my travels and adventure, because that is part of my interest, is travel and adventure. I'm a hill walker, climber, and I've done Kilimanjaro, and I've done a number of other big things in my life that certainly satisfies that. But the wine thing has been, let's just say, a high level of interest for me in terms of traveling around the world. And I've been in most countries actually sampling the wine straight from the vineyards.
And in terms of Australia then, being here 18 years, where do we sit on the wine scale for you?
In terms of quantity?
Quality.
Quality. Oh, well, there's an interesting question. Yeah, look, I think as your tastes mature with your age, so does hopefully your pocket. And I guess I'm probably one of those guys that enjoys the sort of middle to higher end of the wine ranges. I mean, I've got 100 dozen bottles in my cellar that I've had for, in some cases, 30 or 40 years that I've collected straight from vineyards in France and Spain and the US and so on. And I don't know if they're drinkable anymore, in truth.
Yeah, they're better to look at in age every year, or they've gone up another year.
Yeah, so the wine thing has been really important, but there's an important balance, of course, with mixing up more fitness when you're drinking more wine. So yeah, I'm on the higher end of the scale of quality of wine that I enjoy.
The Australian vineyards, you enjoy them?
Absolutely. Yeah. I had the good fortune in my early stages of coming to Australia to be working in Adelaide on an amazing project with EDS and Westpac. And as I was here, but living in the United Kingdom, I actually took the time to visit all of the major vineyards and regions around South
Australia.
It'll
take you a couple of years, wouldn't it?
It's 6 months, actually.
From McLaren Vale to Coonawarra and the Adelaide Hills.
Absolutely. No, I just love the wines from that district. But I've got a broad-ranging palate, and I guess one of the questions a lot of people, so what's your favourite wine, Alistair?
Oh, I'm not going to do that, but you can do that if you want. Yeah.
Okay, well, you see, I actually have a great passion and flavour for South African wines, and particularly Pinotage.
Yeah.
There have been complicated to get in the early years.
Stellenbosch is one of the regions there. What was the other region there? That there's another major region there next to Stellenbosch, pretty much.
Now, I was supposed to go there last year on a tour with my wife. So the Pinotage from the South South Africa is probably one of my best flavoured wines that I would enjoy. But it's not easy to get, particularly the high-end quality ones.
No, not particularly here. Have you been over there at all?
To Africa?
Yeah,
absolutely. I actually have been in Africa two or three times in my lifetime. I enjoy that. As I said to you earlier, I had a good fortune to have climbed Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. But I've also been in North Africa as well, along the coast there, and South Africa. Well, actually, for a Tri Nations game in Pretoria against New Zealand against the
Springboks. Very good. What's it called? I can't remember anyway. But yeah, that wine region, I'm pretty sure I've been there. But Al, we've digressed a little bit off that. But thank you so much for coming in and telling the story about that change, the listed company, how you've embedded the strategy from the acquisition of Wirecard into where you are now, the recent milestones and the outlook in regards to where fintech is in the future. I really appreciate you coming in and look forward to catching up.
All right. Thank you, Chris. Great to see you.
For more information on Sub11, jump onto our LinkedIn or email me, chris@sub11.com.au. Thanks for listening.
Listen to the Unfunded podcast brought to you by the Day One Network and hosted by me, tech writer Joan Westenberg. We're sharing the no-holds-barred, untold stories from entrepreneurs who have decided to build a business on their terms. I'll be interviewing successful founders and operators on the grit and ingenuity it takes to build and scale independent startups without the support of traditional venture capital funding. Subscribe to the Unfunded podcast now, wherever you get your podcasts.